Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Personal Capital. Personal Capital offers insightful, free tools that help you manage all of your finances in a single location with one secure login. The tools are free, personalized, easy to set up and use, and give investors a convenient way to gain transparency into their finances. I know because I've been using the online tool for years for a holistic picture of my financial life, including investments and overall net worth. Today, for listeners of the Meb Faber Show, Personal Capital is offering a special deal, 2 months of free advisory services on top of the already free tools. To learn more and claim 2 months free, just go to personalcapital.com/Meb. Again, that's personalcapital.com/Meb. And now on to the show. Hello, podcast listeners. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, Hanukkah, Festivus, all that good stuff. We're getting down near the end of the year. So we're going to squeeze in a few different ideas. Today, we have a Mebcast, which means no guest, no Jeff, just me. So if that's your idea of a nightmare 20, 30, 40 minutes spent alone in the car with just me or at the gym, sign off now. You've had your fair warning. What are we going to do today? This is going to be a fun retrospective. So today we're looking back at my very first white paper, wrote over 10 years ago. And this is actually a draft of a paper that's coming out in the Journal of Portfolio Management. It will be in their multi-asset special, which I think is either the end of 2017, early 2018. So you're getting an early look. The name of this is A Quantitative Approach to Tactical Asset Allocation, Revisited 10 Years Later. So I'm going to read it. I'm going to say side note if there's some times where I want to take a deviation or just riff as opposed to just the text. But hope you like it. This is a fun look back at kind of, as the Allman Brothers would say, where it all began. So let's get started. In 2006, we wrote a draft white paper titled A Simple Approach to Market Timing, which introduced a basic market timing strategy. I circulated it amongst various friends, professionals, but quickly found that no one was particularly interested in reading it. It's a nice way of saying no one wanted to read it whatsoever. Eventually, I changed the title to A Quantitative Approach to Tactical Asset Allocation and published it in 2007. I think the white paper got circulated maybe 05 or 06. Shortly thereafter, the world was rocked by the global financial crisis. The strategy detailed in our paper performed admirably in the turmoil. Likely because of the performance of this simple system, a quantitative approach to asset allocation would go on to become the most downloaded paper of all time on the Social Science Research Network, which is SSRN, with approximately 200,000 downloads. I kind of smile when I say that, side note, because that's kind of like Crash Davis's famous line in Bull Durham, where he gets the home run record in the minor league. So being the most downloaded on the academic database is kind of like being the best ninth grade basketball player. I don't know, but we'll take it. It's pretty cool to look back. A lot of the other authors in the top 10 are pretty famous. There's some Nobel laureates thrown in. What I don't mention in the article, by the way, is the origins of the paper was that I was actually trying to avoid taking a test. Was actually going through the third level of the CMT designation, which is the Market Technicians Association, the Chartered Market Technician, which is kind of the technical analyst version of the CFA. And back then they announced they were doing away with the white paper requirement. So by the end of the year, so I turned in an abstract on like December 30th, snuck it in, and then had to go write a paper, which eventually became this paper. A big hat tip to one of my favorite people on the planet, Rob Arnott, who was then the Journal of Finance, I believe, editor, or Financial Analyst Journal. He actually read it, gave me some fantastic constructive criticism, harsh but fair. The probably dozen or two dozen other people I sent it to, most either didn't read it or sent me some pretty nasty comments, including some very, very famous authors and hedge fund managers I won't mention. It's the holiday season. Anyway, let's get back to the paper and read where we've been since then in the past 10 years. So 10 years have passed. So we thought it would be interesting to examine how well this timing strategy held up. What lessons have been learned? What might have been done differently with the benefit of hindsight? And what possible extensions and deviations exist for further explorations? Now, noted, this is not intended to be an expansion of the original article. We did that in Faber 2013. We published an update to the original that included a bunch of new content. Rather, this is meant to just be an accompaniment, a reflection on the performance of a timing model using in and out of sample data in the years since publication. So what was the original system? For those of you who may not have read the original article or benefit from a little bit of a refresher, the timing strategy examined was a trend following strategy. Trend following is one of the oldest market strategies. It's been around since at least the time of Charles Dow in the early 20th century. The most often cited long-term measure of trend, the probably most famous one, is the 200-day simple moving average. So therefore, we decided to use this as our starting point. I make no claims to originality. People sometimes meet are like, Meb thinks he invented this. No, this has been around for forever. So we use the monthly version of this. It's 10-month simple moving average. The reason we did that was just there's not that much historical data. It goes back that far for daily. So we wanted to use as much data as possible. And the criteria necessary for this model to be simple enough for investors to follow, mechanical enough to remove emotion and subjective decision-making. One, we wanted to have a simple, purely mechanical logic. Two, the same model and parameters must be used for every asset class. And three, you wanted to just be price-based only. One of my favorite investing quotes is, price is unique as an indicator is that it can't diverge from itself. Any other indicator you have could diverge, whereas price is unique in that. Anyway, so what was the logic? We only had one rule, simplest system on the planet. And that is we wanted to buy when the security is in an uptrend, sell it when it's in a downtrend. So specifically, the buy rule is to buy something when the monthly price was above the 10-month simple moving average. You sell it and move to cash when the monthly price was less than the 10-month moving average. That's it. Takes 5 minutes a month. A few clarifications. All the entry and exit points were on the day of the signal at the close. It's only updated once a month, the last day of the month. Price fluctuations during the rest of the month are ignored. We use total return data. Cash returns or 90-day T-bills. We ignore taxes, commission, slippage. We'll talk about that later. And if you look back in the original paper, before we examine the performance, I said, here's a quote, "The attempt is not to build an optimization model. Parentheses, indeed, the chosen parameter is decidedly suboptimal as evidenced later in this article, but to build a simple trading model that works in most markets. The results suggest that a market timing solution is a risk reduction technique rather than a return enhancing one. The empirical results are equity-like returns with bond-like volatility and drawdown." So it's important to understand that beating the market was never the goal of the paper. The intent was to identify a trading system that largely approximated market returns, yet it did so with less volatility and risk. The reason for this is simple. Emotions can wreak havoc on investors' ability to follow their own stated investment plan. All too often, we fall victim to fear when markets have turned against us and sell at nearly the worst possible time. A lot of us can think back to 2009, how hard it was to sit through that. Although many market historians enjoy pointing towards the healthy long-term average return of most equity indices, what good are those long-term averages if fear causes an investor to sell near a market low? So it was with this question in mind that I sought a model that dramatically reduced volatility and drawdowns. The hope was that by implementing such a model, investors could avoid the exaggerated turbulence often results in emotion-based, money-losing market decisions. So, did it work? Did the model work as intended? The original article was published with data up through 2005, so we'll examine the historical in-sample results as well as the out-of-sample results in the 11 years since. So before delving into the data, what's transpired in the past decade? Anything? We've seen the Boston Marathon bombing, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Affordable Care Act, continued war with ISIS, Ebola, Zika, one of the most partisan periods ever in American politics, culminating in the election of Donald Trump, and now the increasing threat of war with North Korea. In the investing world, we've seen global financial crisis, U.S. housing meltdown, followed by the steady march of this historic bull market, the end of the Fed's quantitative easing program, historic lows in bond yields, including some negative global sovereign yields, one of the biggest surprises, I think, of the past 10 years, and multi-decade highs and lows in oil prices, among other stories. What has this meant for asset allocation strategies in our simple model? Have any of these headlines meant this time is different? Change has always been the constant of markets, and indeed, has anything new really been seen in our world of investing? Bubbles, defaults, government inventions, bear markets, fortunes made and lost. They've all happened before. So to answer this question, let's first examine the timing model in U.S. stocks before moving to the perspective of an asset allocation portfolio. Now recall all the many caveats to studies such as this. First, most of the early part of the 20th century, There was no way to trade an index fund as the S&P 500. I don't think they really existed until the 70s. Even you could buy a basket of stocks back then. Trading based on a trend system would have been costly because of commissions and friction such as the bid-ask spread. However, it's still useful to test the algorithm on historic data to help establish a framework for how a modern system may have performed in the past with a nod to the future. So we show an exhibit in the paper, which you'll have to download to look at. We'll post in the show notes. But it shows that utilizing a timing system would have largely avoided the significant bear markets in the 1930s, 2000s, for example, but it wouldn't have left the investor completely unscathed from those bear markets, nor would it have saved the investor from the sharp drop in 1987. That's an interesting subnote we'll come back to later. And if you look at more the kind of recent 1990 to 2016 period, a few timing features stand out. First, a trend following model can underperform buy and hold during a roaring bull market, such as the US equity market in the 90s. On the flip side, a timing model can avoid lengthy and protracted bear markets. So consequently, the value added by timing is only evident over the course of an entire business and market cycle. Most people want to identify any investment approach over weeks, months, quarters, but really it's years and almost decades. So many people look at the equity curves in the paper and think, look, they both basically end up in the same place. Is it even worth it to implement a timing model? That's a valid question. And I think if you're a buy and hold investor that can live through bear markets down 40, 60, 80% and stay the course, you may not need a trend following system. However, as we mentioned earlier, many investors cannot handle the drawdowns. And as many advisors can attest, investors of all types, stripes, tempted to capitulate and sell in bear markets. On the flip side, market timing provides its own set of challenges, namely whipsaws with false signals, often that are found in choppy markets. And one of the hardest emotional challenges of investing is looking different than your peers when they're performing well. With this historical perspective in mind, let's now turn the results of the model since the original publication. We'll look at in-sample versus out-of-sample. So, U.S. stocks, in-sample, 1901 to 2005, did 9.65%. Timing up that to 10.36%. Pretty good, right? Volatility went down. I'm going to start rounding because it's too hard to do decimals. So U.S. stocks 9.6, timing 10.3, so better. Volatility went from 18% down to 12. That's a huge reduction in volatility. Sharpe ratio went up from 33 to 55. Max drawdown, big one, went from 83 down to 50%. So how'd that do? So good across the board, right? But obviously it's good because that was the in sample period. Let's look at since publication, 2006 to 16. U.S. stocks, still pretty good, 7.6%. Timing better, 8.5. Volatility went down from 14.6 down to 9.4. That also goes to show how much lower volatility this period has been recently in particular. Sharpe ratio, 0.45 up to 0.8. And the big drawdown of the 51%er in the global financial crisis got reduced to 16%. So not bad. Also, inflation was lower around 1.8 versus 3.1. So pretty darn good. So a cursory review reveals that the timing solution improved compound returns while reducing risk and drawdowns in both periods. Volatility is measured, by the way, as annualized standard deviation of monthly returns. Drawdown, if you're not familiar, is peak to trough decline in investment. So if you bought something 100 grand, went down to 50 grand, then on the way back up to 200, you lost 50% at one point. So after publication of the article, U.S. stocks got pummeled, right? Then continued this massive bull market up. And if you look at the out-of-sample performance, timing did a monster job in 2008, actually had a slight positive year. But then the problem is it trailed after that period. And a lot of investors implement investment approaches after the fact, wishing they had in the past. So a lot of investors who have implementing the timing model after the crash probably really likely struggled with staying the course with the tactical approach in the years to follow. Though most investors don't just own U.S. stocks, but instead allocate to a broad spectrum of assets, including bonds, foreign assets, real assets. So let's turn our attention now to the performance of the timing model as applied to a diversified global portfolio. If you all read my favorite investing book, Dimson Marsh Staunton's Triumph of the Optimist, 101 Years of Global Investment Returns, that book illustrates many global asset classes in the 20th century produced spectacular gains in wealth for people that bought and held those assets for generation-long holding periods. Of course, all those assets went through regular and painful drawdowns, such as we just experienced in 2008-09. All of the G7 countries have experienced at least one period where stocks lost three quarters of their value. Think about that, 75%. Unfortunate math of a 75% decline requires an investor a 300% gain to get back to even. That's the equivalent of compounding at 10% for 15 years. So what do most investors do? Solution for most investors is diversify across uncorrelated assets and return streams. Every bear market has a different personality, of course. 2003 was largely confined to high-flying tech stocks, and many assets and securities came nowhere near close to experiencing the major losses suffered by market cap-weighted U.S. stock indices. So if you look at kind of the five main asset classes we're going to talk about, and long-term followers are familiar, U.S. stocks, foreign stocks, bonds, REITs, and commodities. And so if you look at the drawdowns during this period from, and this is the modern era, 72 to 05, U.S. stocks, foreign stocks both declined around 44 to 47%, bonds 15, REITs almost 60, and commodities almost 50. So pretty nasty declines, of course, during that period, but strong returns across the board, U.S. stocks 11, foreign 11, bonds 8, REITs 10.5, commodities 12, and then a buy and hold asset allocation 11.5. And by the way, the Sharpe ratios range for those asset classes from a low of 0.24 for U.S. bonds to a high of 0.32 for U.S. stocks. And the portfolio, you put them all together, we call it the global asset allocation. And you end up with a pretty awesome 11.5% return, 8% vol, 0.6 Sharpe, and a slightly lower than 20% drawdown. So diversification 101, you put a bunch of stuff together, you end up in a better place than either of those by themselves. So how did everything, and that's all buy and hold, by the way, how did all those asset classes perform in the out-of-sample period since 2005? Well, as we all recall, the normal benefits diversification disappeared in 2008, as many what people consider to be historical non-correlated assets experienced large declines simultaneously. Although we mentioned before, every bear market has its own personality. 2003 was largely tech, market cap weighted. 08-09 bear was felt almost across the board. So if you saw that original global asset allocation portfolio, which did 11.5 with a 20% drawdown in the period since publication in the 10 years, it only did 3.5% with a 12% volatility, a 0.19% Sharpe ratio, and a 46% decline. That is over double the maximum drawdown over the past 30 years prior to 1972. And that's one of the reasons it surprised people so much is that bear market had a different personality, really reflects what happened in the 1930s. Most people managing money weren't around doing that. So if you look at a lot of the asset classes, instead of this, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12% returns, they're now down to 3, 4, 7. Commodities were negative. And in some cases, the declines were 50, 60, 70, 80%. So pretty nasty maximum drawdowns, particularly in commodities. Let's take a moment to hear from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Personal Capital. Guys, there's a lot of things I like about Personal Capital. They offer free digital tools that help me view all my investments in a single location on my phone, tablet, or desktop. The help they provide is highly personalized, including a sophisticated tool to evaluate what I'm paying in fees over time. And overall, they give me a thorough, insightful snapshot of all my finances, helping me feel more empowered and confident in knowing exactly where my money stands. Do you know that the typical affluent household has 15 to 20 financial accounts? With Personal Capital's tools, you can link your account to common account types and even assets like property investments and stock options. And today, for listeners of the Matt Faber Show, Personal Capital is offering a special deal. 2 months of free advisory services on top of the already free tools. To learn more and claim your 2 months free, just go to personalcapital.com/Meb. Again, that's personalcapital.com/Meb. And now, back to the show. Let's now evaluate the timing model on the aggregated portfolio level. So comparing the buy and hold of each of those asset classes, 20% each, U.S. stocks, foreign stocks, bonds, REITs, commodities. And then on the timing model, looks at each asset class independently. Are you in U.S. stocks? Are you out? If you're out, you sit in cash. So additional advantages conferred by timing are actually pretty striking. It results in a reduction of volatility to single-digit levels, as well as single-digit maximum drawdown in both periods. So if you look at 72 to 05, asset allocation did 11.5. The timing system added a little bit of returns, 20 basis points, but not the point. Took vol down from almost 9 to almost 7. Sharpe ratio increase and drawdown was roughly in half. Out of sample period, again, buy and hold 3.5%, way lower. Timing higher, 4.8. Volatility got cut in half, 12.8 to 6.5. Sharpe ratio doubled from 0.19 to 0.59. Most importantly, drawdown went from 46% down to 9.45. So pretty great checkmark metrics across the board. And so some people say, well, Meb, are these results some way skewed or influenced by the specific parameter chosen? And again, these are out of sample, so it's we're optimizing the out of sample period. But if you look at all sorts of different timing indicators, so everything from, say, 6 month to 8 month to 12 month moving averages, they all end up actually, the 10 month is not superior on any metric, whether it's return, vol, sharp, or drawdown, something else did better. So that's what we call parameter stability, which is something you want to see when you have a timing model like this, that everything tends to work. So since the publication of this original white paper, super simple, we've written 6 books, 10 more white papers, 2,000 blog articles, and produced nearly 100 podcast episodes. It's kind of insane. Some of this content addressed in varying degrees how an investor might improve upon or alter that basic system. So the intent of the original paper was to demonstrate a simple tactical system. An investor can take significant departures to tailor a portfolio to his or her own investing temperament. We've had thousands of emails over the years that people ask questions, say, hey, can I do this? Can I switch that? So we'll talk about a few deviations that we would like to re-examine. Some of these have been published since the original paper, so that we can't really consider this out of sample, though some were published in 2008, then 9, then 10, 11, 12, 13, yada, yada. Y'all been following the blog and papers long enough, it will be very familiar with these. But there's 3 main ones to think about. The first, alternative cash management strategies. Second, alternative weighting strategies. And lastly, adding more asset class and tilts. So first one, alternative cash management. So if you think about it, on average, the timing portfolio is invested in approximately 30% cash on average, because at any time, one or more of the asset classes may not be invested because of the trading rules. I mean, in general, the timing model has you invested like 2/3 of the time, but that means about 1/3 of the time you're sitting in cash. And it's only like one trade per year per asset class. But that means on average, you're sitting in a pretty significant cash chunk. And that's a drag, right? T-bills tend to have pretty low yields, lower than certainly bonds and long-term bonds. So the yield in the cash portfolio, using any number of funds or concepts people use as a way to optimize cash. So if you instead say, hey, look, instead of bills, I'm going to use bonds, 10-year bonds, that actually increases your return about 1% a year. Volatility comes up a little bit. Sharpe ratio increases, however, and drawdown is basically roughly the same. So you get about a 200 basis point bump, 2 percentage points. Now, listeners say, well, Meb, that's of course because bonds have been in a bull market for 3 decades of that period. We said, all right, well, let's just examine using the timing model with bills and bonds in the highly inflationary 1972 to 81, and it actually still helped. You still got that 200 basis point bump, increase in sharp, drawdown roughly the same, which is pretty interesting to me. So it's worked in most periods of both inflation as well as in disinflation and close to outright deflation. So that may be an interesting choice for you, is use bonds instead of just bills or some other cash management. 2, weighting strategies. So no 2 investors are alike. Some optimize in wealth preservation with low volatility above all else. Some can handle a 50% loss on the path to try to generate higher gains. So what we've done originally in this paper is we just looked at one set model, but we could actually tailor it to what we consider maybe 3 different allocations, one being conservative, one being moderate, one being aggressive. So we use the base case one we've been talking about this whole time as moderate. So conservative, we'll say, hey, we'll just put a higher weighting in bonds. So instead of 20% standard, we'll do 40. And then aggressive, we'll combine 2 of our favorite things. So we'll combine 2 close cousins, momentum and trends. The aggressive will select the top 3 out of the 5 asset classes, ranked by just whatever traditional momentum metrics, 1, 3, 6 month total returns. And then if they're above their long-term trend, and this was detailed in a paper we wrote called Relative Strength Strategies for Investing, I think back in 2010. So what does that look like? All right, well, the conservative, as you imagine, lowers returns, lowers volatility, same Sharpe ratio, lower drawdown. And that makes sense. The more cash you add to something, you're going to have lower volatility, lower drawdown, and lower returns. So for people to say, look, I like this timing model, but 20% in bonds isn't enough. I'm going to go 40 or 60 or 80. I think that makes sense. And you could perform exactly as you expect. And then if you said, flip it, I'm going to do the aggressive. When you combine momentum and trend, that's where you actually get outperformance. That is a return seeking strategy, return enhancing. So that adds about 300-ish basis points. Volatility, of course, comes up. Sharpe ratio is higher. Maximum drawdown doesn't increase that much. And partially that's because of the trend following filter. We found that it's still a pretty darn good portfolio. Now you're going to end up being more concentrated at times, but that's the whole point. If you're going to be an active investor, you need to be weird, you need to be concentrated, you need to be different. So you can also add more asset classes and tilts. So other than simplicity, there's no reason to focus just on these five asset classes. Technically, we believe there's only four asset classes, by the way: stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies. Everything else, kind of like REITs, is sort of a combination of the other four, or say corporate bonds. Anyway, if you expand it to, but if you start getting this huge asset allocation with these tiny positions at 1%, 2%, or 3%, it doesn't really make any impact because size is less than 5%, have a marginal impact on the entire portfolio risk reward characteristics. So we face the challenge that many asset classes and index simply have not existed for a long time. So in this examination, we're not going to include TIPS, junk, high yield bonds, emerging market foreign REITs, fundamental indexes, managed futures, currencies, other asset classes we might otherwise consider. So we came up with 13 subgroups that will cover most of the global market portfolio that we'd like to allocate to while maintaining a large enough allocation for the effect to have on the overall portfolio performance. So I'm not going to detail this, but includes tilts to things like value and momentum in equities. It includes foreign bonds. It includes commodities as well as gold. And of course, the real estate investment trusts. Now, we're adding these tilts with the full benefit of hindsight. So we know that value and momentum worked in the past. So just noted. Regardless, I still think it's a reasonable modification to make if implemented in a thoughtful and cost-effective manner. So a lot of these, what we call smart beta tilts, investors need to be mindful of the fees you pay to express these asset class tilts in your portfolio. So many funds are sold on Wall Street with 1, 2, 3% expense ratios, which would likely destroy, of course, all the potential alpha the funds may generate in the first place. So if you look at the historical returns of the simple strategy on top of the normal five asset class allocation, using these smart beta and different tilts for same volatility, same drawdown, you add about another 150 basis point returns. So pretty cool. Smart beta, right? You tilt towards value, tilt towards momentum. It's really tilting away from market cap portfolio. Doesn't really matter what you do. You end up with a higher return. And then, of course, doing the same thing with the timing model, it kind of just elevates it another 100 basis points over the timing model using those tilts. And then, of course, you can start to combine all of these into one. And again, we kind of smile while we're saying this because there's limitless extensions. So you can incorporate the tilts as well as the granularity, as well as the aggressive approach, as well as the cash management, and put this all into one. And you end up obviously with very extremely high returns, with marginal volatility, a sharp ratio of above one, and a reasonable drawdown. But again, some of this is just simply saying we know what a lot of the stuff worked in the past, combining it all together. Of course, you're going to end up with a high sharp ratio, but I think a lot of these tilts and deviations are based on historically sound research and would have no problem implementing them going forward. So let's say you want to implement it. There's a lot of practical considerations to consider. Tongue twister. So namely, management fees, taxes, commissions, slippage. Management fees should be identical for both buy and hold as well as timing models, and varies depending on the instruments you're using. Fair estimate, if you're using ETFs, no-load mutual funds, obviously the lower the fee, the better, but you could get as low as like 3 basis points today with some of these funds, as high as maybe 70 basis points if you're using some smart beta stuff. All ETF portfolios can be found approximately the lowest, I think, ETF portfolio in the world costs about 5 basis points, but 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, even 60, 70, totally reasonable. Make sure you want to keep it below 1% for sure. Commissions at this point, day and age, are a minimal factor. These models have low turnover. And in general, you're making a few round trip trades per year and less than one round trip trade per asset. However, slippage also nearly negligible. An investor could use numerous mutual funds, which have intraday pricing, so zero slippage, as well as liquid ETFs. And there's many brokerages today that offer very low commission trading, $5 for Schwab, I think. And a lot of them even have zero cost trading, Robinhood and others. Taxes are a very real consideration, of course. Many institutional investors, such as endowment and pension funds, enjoy tax-exempt status, although that may change with the new rules. But the obvious solution for individuals is to trade the system in a tax-deferred account, such as an IRA or 401k. Because the various capital gains rates are different for investors, as well as varying tax rates over time and the impact of dividends, it's difficult to estimate the hit an investor would suffer from moving from buy and hold to trading this in a taxable account. But most people rebalance their holdings periodically anyway, introduce some turnover in the portfolio, even if they did buy and hold. I think if I remember correctly, in the original paper, we assumed it was around 50 basis point impact. I can't remember. I'll have to look it up. Anyway,
The trend following system in general results in a higher number of short-term capital losses and a larger percentage of long-term capital gains. That's just definition of trend following, which is a good thing. So let's reflect. You know, the purpose of this original article was to kind of take a look at a very simple method for trying to manage risk in a single asset class and extension a portfolio of assets. We looked at a monthly system since 1972. An investor would have been able to increase risk-adjusted returns by diversifying portfolio assets and employing a market timing solution. In addition, the investor would have been able to sidestep many of the protracted bear markets in various asset classes, and avoiding these massive losses would have resulted in equity-like returns with bond-like volatility and drawdowns. Investors looking to tailor their portfolios could consider using alternate cash strategies, more assets in the portfolio, and alternative weighting schemes to find a portfolio that is right for them. And as I look back and reflect, we find that the timing system has performed as expected out of sample, which is to say perform well. Given this, it's tempting to give ourselves a pat on the back. Say, Meb, you so smart. However, what if it had done poorly? Likely no one would be reading this article, listening to this podcast, because it never would have become popular in the first place. So despite the great out-of-sample performance, is it fair to judge our timing system in such a short a time? Probably not. The value of such a model is better evaluated over the course of multiple decades rather than years, and certainly not quarters. And this might be especially important given where we stand today, looking forward to what could be in store for the markets over the next decade. Although investors have benefited from strong equity markets since the global financial crisis, the opportunity set for domestic investments is quite poor. We've talked a lot about this. Valuations for U.S. stocks using the 10-year Shiller cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio have risen above a value of 30, which puts them well above long-term average around 17 and the long-term average of 21 for lower inflation periods. Such a reading suggests that future returns could underperform historical long-term averages. Even the father of indexing, John Bogle, recently suggested U.S. stocks might return about 4% in the coming decade. Are we going to expect any help from bonds? Probably not. Probably the opposite is what we should expect. U.S. government bonds have climbed to all-time low yield levels. They're up some, but still around 2.3%. Looking forward, we expect future total bond return to approximate their starting yield. So given this, investors are presented with the following opportunity set. We'll assume 2% inflation going forward just to make it simple and also round. So say U.S. stocks do 4, nominal, 2% real, bonds 2, nominal, 0% real. So will U.S. equities significantly underperform their long-term averages? What direction will U.S. bond yields go? Will alternative global asset classes provide a better place for investment capital? No one can answer these questions with complete accuracy, but given that, it's crucial to invest thoughtfully and deliberately. Most importantly, every investor should have a plan and a process for investing in any environment, regardless of how improbable, unfathomable that may be. Are you prepared for all the possible outcomes, such as declines of 50% in an asset class or portfolio? Are you prepared not only for currency devaluations, but also massive rallies in stocks and bonds? Can you fathom a world with interest rates at zero, as well as 10%? The beauty of the simplistic timing model documented in this piece is that it's dynamic, therein enabling us to answer yes to the questions above. Whether you deem it appropriate or not, for your own investing style, the broader point remains. Do you have a plan or process that has prepared you for tomorrow's market in whatever condition you may find it? That's it for our draft reading, guys. Hope you didn't fall asleep, crash your car. Hope the gym session was great. We'll post a link to this paper when it comes out. Hopefully it's end of the year, maybe first quarter, with all the various charts, updates, numbers, etc. And hope you guys liked it. I hope everyone listening has an outstanding holiday season. It's been a lot of fun this year. We've had a great time with Jeff and all the guests. I really enjoyed you guys listening. I really appreciate the time you spend on it. So if you guys got any feedback, y'all don't send us too much, but would love to hear some suggestions, ideas, questions, thoughts, comments, presents. Feedback at themebfavorshow.com. You can always find the rest of the show notes. We're approaching 100 and all the episodes at mebfavor.com/podcast. You can always subscribe to the show on iTunes, all the other players. Thanks for listening, friends. Happy holidays and good investing.